Are you improving outcomes with SpHb? Continuous SpHb monitoring provides real-time visibility to changes or lack of changes in hemoglobin concentration between invasive blood draws and has been shown in multiple studies to help clinicians improve outcomes. Visit Masimo.com to learn more.
Hi, this is Evan Karish, Editor-in-Chief of Anesthesiology, with some highlights from the March 2021 issue as selected by the journal editors. Let's begin this month with a clinical study on the important issue of postoperative pain. So a team of investigators evaluated the patterns of acute postoperative pain in a mixed surgical patient cohort. Dr. Terry Vassilopoulos and colleagues at the University of Florida conducted this study. Their hypothesis was that there would be heterogeneity in the patterns of postoperative pain. They used the brief pain inventory, and they measured pain daily on postoperative days 1 through 7 in 360 patients. They then used group-based trajectory modeling to estimate the trajectories and the patterns of postoperative pain. They identified 5 distinct postoperative pain trajectories. The trajectories were low pain, moderate to low pain, moderate to high pain, and decreasing pain. Nearly half the patients were in the moderate to high pain group with an average pain score of 6 out of 10. A quarter of the patients were in the moderate to low pain group, and the rest of the patients were in either the high, low, or decreasing pain groups. In general, nearly two-thirds of patients had high or moderate to high pain over the first 7 days following surgery, a rather large percentage. Multivariable analysis showed that younger age, female sex, and greater anxiety made it more likely that patients would be in the high pain group. Postoperative pain trajectories were not associated with preoperative opioid use or intraoperative opioid use. But the pain trajectory was, however, associated with postoperative opioid use. And that is, the patients who were in the high pain group required 4 times more opioids than those in the low pain group. The investigators concluded that postoperative pain trajectories were predominantly defined by patient factors, not surgical factors. Our next clinical study explored the effects of severe COVID-19 on patients' hemostatic balance. Dr. Christoph Heinz and colleagues at University Hospital in Frankfurt and Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany, conducted the study. They assessed the details of clot formation and clot lysis in 27 critically ill COVID-19 patients using point-of-care diagnostics. They performed aggregometric and viscoelastometric measures in the ICU to assess the patient population's comprehensive hemostatic profile. Then they compared the data to that from healthy controls. The study did not find a greater platelet aggregability based on impedance aggregometric tests. But thromboelastometry in COVID-19 patients revealed greater maximum clot firmness and longer lysis time and activation of fibrinolysis. This was generally described as greater resistance to fibrinolysis. The authors concluded that these findings may contribute to our understanding of the hypercoagulable state of a critically ill patient's with COVID-19. Next, we have a clinical study that addresses the question of how best to appropriately transfuse red blood cells to patients. It examined the role that central venous oxygen saturation measurements can play in deciding whether to transfuse patients after cardiac surgery. Dr. Nourdine Zerul and colleagues at Montpellier University, Montpellier, France, conducted the study. They designed a randomized trial to test whether transfusion decisions that are guided by central venous oxygen saturation could reduce the transfusion incidence in the ICU after cardiac surgery. Adults were screened before cardiac surgery. The patients were randomized to either the control group or the central venous oxygen saturation measurement group. The patients then entered the study if they developed anemia. This was defined as a hemoglobin less than 9 grams per deciliter and without active bleeding during their post-op ICU stay. The control patients were transfused at each anemia episode based only on hemoglobin concentration. Patients in the active intervention group were transfused only if their central venous oxygen saturation was less than or equal to 65%. All 50 control patients were transfused in the ICU. In the group whose transfusion was guided by central venous oxygen saturation, only about 2/3 of patients were transfused. Control patients received a total of 94 red blood cell units, while the intervention group received only 65 red blood cell units. And the investigators concluded that a more restrictive transfusion strategy that was guided by central venous oxygen saturation measurement may allow for significant reduction in the incidence of transfusion. Our next clinical study compared postoperative cognitive outcomes associated with two commonly used anesthetics. Dr. Yuxuan Li of Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou, China, and colleagues elsewhere conducted this study. They tested the hypothesis that patients with laparoscopic abdominal surgery under propofol-based anesthesia would be less likely to have delayed neurocognitive recoveries compared to patients under sevoflurane-based anesthesia. The authors also sought blood biomarkers that could predict delayed neurocognitive recovery. They conducted a randomized, double-blind, parallel group controlled study at 4 hospitals in China. The eligible patients were older adults whose laparoscopic abdominal surgery was expected to last longer than 2 hours. These patients were randomized to receive either a propofol-based anesthetic or a sevoflurane-based anesthetic. And the primary outcome was the incidence of delayed neurocognitive recovery 5 to 7 days after surgery. What the investigators found was that about 21% of patients in the sevoflurane group and 17% of patients in the propofol group had delayed neurocognitive recovery. And this was not a clinically or statistically significant difference. The authors concluded that the choice of propofol or sevoflurane did not appear to affect the incidence of delayed neurocognitive recovery 5 to 7 days after laparoscopic abdominal surgery. Next, we have a clinical feasibility study. It evaluated whether on-demand washing of allogeneic red blood cells may help mitigate adverse transfusion reactions. Dr. Ian Wellesby of Duke University and colleagues there and elsewhere conducted the study. They tested the hypothesis that on-demand bedside washing of allogeneic red blood cell units could successfully remove certain soluble factors such as cell-derived microvesicles, soluble CD4 ligand, chemokine ligand 5, and neutral lipids, all of which were previously associated with transfusion reactions. The investigators also wanted to test the feasibility of using a cell saver during cardiac surgery. The authors collected laboratory data from the first 75 washed units given to a subset of patients in an intervention arm of a clinical trial. Paired pre- and post-wash samples from the blood unit bags were centrifuged. The supernatant was aspirated and frozen, and then it was batch tested at the end of the study for soluble factors. The authors found that cell-derived microvesicles, soluble CD40 ligand, and chemokine ligand 5 concentrations all decreased significantly after washing. Cell-free hemoglobin concentrations increased threefold after washing, but neutral lipids were unchanged. The authors concluded that bedside red blood cell washing in the operating room was clinically feasible, and that washing significantly reduced the concentrations of soluble factors thought to be associated with transfusion-related adverse reactions. Cell-free hemoglobin concentrations were increased by washing, but hemolysis remained within an acceptable degree, less than 0.8%. Our next article reports a laboratory study which used a mouse model to explore the role of positive regulatory domain 1 binding factor in the regulation of nociception after peripheral nerve injury. Dr. Kunjin Wang of Fudan University in Shanghai and colleagues there and elsewhere in China conducted the study. They tested the hypothesis that positive regulatory domain binding factor 1, or PRDM1, in the dorsal root ganglion may contribute to the regulation of nociception that is caused by injuries such as chronic nerve constriction, injection of complete Freund's adjuvant, or the injection of capsaicin. They also tested a hypothesis that this mechanism may involve KV4.3 potassium channels. After causing these various injuries, the authors evaluated the responses of mice to mechanical stimulation, thermal stimulation, and they also analyzed their gait. The authors evaluated the role of PRDM1 by knocking down PRDM1. They found that peripheral nerve injury increased PRDM1 expression in the dorsal root ganglion, and this increased expression reduced the activity of the KV4.3 promoter and repressed the expression of KV4.3 potassium channels. The authors concluded that PRDM1 contributes to nociception caused by peripheral nerve injury, and that by repressing potassium channel expression in injured dorsal root ganglion neurons. Next, we have a clinical focus review article that discusses perioperative platelet therapy. Dr. Aaron Stansberry Hess of the University of Wisconsin and colleagues there and at the University of Washington authored this article. They examined multiple aspects of perioperative platelet therapy, including guidelines, physiologic evidence, and the results of randomized clinical trials. The authors emphasize in the article that most perioperative practices are not supported by high-quality evidence, which leaves much to each anesthesiologist's clinical judgment. The authors suggest that platelet therapy is best guided by predefined protocols incorporating laboratory testing. They posit that most patients will tolerate various surgical procedures well and without serious complications at lower platelet counts than many society guidelines suggest. They emphasize the urgent need for high-quality clinical trials to investigate platelet storage technologies, platelet function testing, perioperative transfusion strategies, and alternatives to platelets. They conclude that the anesthesiologist must weigh the limited evidence alongside patient, operator, and institutional factors as they decide when to transfuse platelets. And I'll close this month with a narrative review article that examines perioperative stroke. Dr. Philip Vlissides and Laurel Moore at the University of Michigan authored this comprehensive narrative review. They discuss the etiology, common risk factors, and potential risk reduction strategies relating to perioperative stroke. Strategies for reducing the risk of perioperative stroke include delaying elective surgery after a recent stroke and medication optimization. The review article also addresses screening methods to detect postoperative cerebral ischemia. Additionally, anesthesiologists should consider how multidisciplinary collaborations, including endovascular interventions, could be used to improve patient outcomes. Further investigation is required to determine the role of intraoperative physiologic management and stroke risk. In addition, novel strategies are required to improve stroke detection postoperatively. Anesthesiologists can play an important role in leading the required scientific and clinical efforts to advance perioperative stroke understanding and to improve clinical management. As always, I thank you for your interest in and your support of our journal. I hope you'll use the information published in Anesthesiology to guide and to inform and improve your clinical practice. We at the journal look forward to keeping you informed as anesthesiology continues to publish important research and trusted evidence each month.
Are you improving outcomes with SpHb? Continuous SpHb monitoring provides real-time visibility to changes or lack of changes in hemoglobin concentration between invasive blood draws and has been shown in multiple studies to help clinicians improve outcomes. Visit Masimo.com to learn more.